This is Jeff Baker, and I'm the host of TTM Cast, the podcast for the TTM Autograph Collector. And I had the pleasure of interviewing Mr. Ralph Carhart, author of The Hall Ball. So hopefully you will enjoy our interview. If you want to listen to any of my podcasts, you can find my podcast at ttmcast.podbean.com. Once again, my podcast is available at ttmcast.podbean.com.
Joining us on the TTM Cast hotline from his home in Brooklyn is author and baseball historian, Mr. Ralph Carhart. Welcome to the program, Ralph.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Ralph, your book is entitled The Hall Ball, One Fan's Journey to Unite Cooperstown Immortals with a Single Ball, Baseball. It really should be just The Hall Ball because that is primarily the focus of the book. Why don't you let people know how you came up with the title of the book, so to speak, and how this came about?
Well, the book is named after the project itself, the Hall Ball Project, which is a thing that I started in August of 2010. I got the idea to take a baseball that my wife had plucked out of the creek that runs next to Doubleday Field in Cooperstown to all of the members of the Baseball Hall of Fame, living and deceased. I'm a genealogist, so I spend some time in graveyards and enjoy visiting them. And I decided that I wanted to create a project that would unite all of the Hall of Famers in a way that had never really been done before. And I wanted to make sure to include the ones who were no longer with us. So I did that. I spent 8 years taking this baseball to all of the Hall of Famers, and I either took a picture of them holding it if they were still alive or the ball at their grave if they're not.
So this ball wasn't a brand new spanking white ball that you buy out of the store, and it didn't have any special power, so to speak. But I think it did because it found your wife and your family, and you brought it on this journey. It's an amazing task. Did you initially, because you were a genealogist and you like going to graves, did you think just dealing with the deceased players or when did you decide to do everyone? Are you a completist?
The beginning of the project was just visiting the graves. That part of it began because on that same trip where we found the ball when we were at Cooperstown, my wife actually found a grave marked Abner Doubleday. Now it's not our Abner, it's his grandfather. But seeing that was the next piece in the whole puzzle that got me started on it. So when I began, it really was just the graves that I had in mind, but I very quickly into the project, pretty much on the first day out of taking photos, decided that I wanted to expand it. I wanted to include the living guys. I wanted to have all of the Hall of Famers represented in a way that had never been done.
Yeah, it's a great Herculean task, I think, just to, it wasn't something that you could take lightly. You had, 20,000 miles on your car and went to 34 states, and this was a huge undertaking, and it's amazing how much support you got.
Yeah, I underestimated just how huge an undertaking it was when I began. I had some sense about all the travel was going to be because I was able to map that out fairly early. I didn't know it would take me 8 years to do all of the travel. I had no idea how I was going to connect with all of the living guys when I decided to incorporate that into it. So I most definitely did not anticipate how massive this kind of a project would be from the outset. I am extraordinarily fortunate. I have one of the best wives in the entire world. She gets mentioned in just about every interview because how can she not? I mean, not only did she find all of the pieces that sort of put this whole thing in motion, but, she spent 8.5 years traveling around the country with me. Our family vacations were, to places where dead ball players were buried. So both she and my kids were an incredible support throughout the entire journey to help make it possible.
And she got her hand or arm in just about every picture.
not every. There's a few Hall of Famers, you know, the ones who are buried in like mausoleums and stuff like that, where there's nowhere to comfortably rest the ball on a surface. So it has to be held up in front of it. Her hand makes frequent appearances throughout the book. There are a couple of other guest hands that are in there as well. But most of the time, if you see a hand holding a ball, it is hers.
Now, the mythology of Abner Doubleday kind of runs through your journey. Were you surprised at that?
That Abner kept showing up in the story?
Yeah,
especially because Abner, you know, doesn't actually have anything to do with baseball. It all began with finding his grandfather. I, at one point, completely accidentally, in the same cemetery where old Hoss Radbourne is buried, in the middle of Illinois, you know, a third of a country away from Cooperstown, I found Abner Doubleday's father buried in the same cemetery. There was even another little piece of my adventure in which I don't mention in the book because it wasn't directly related to the Hallball and my journeys, but tangentially, where I also found his brother. His brother was buried on Staten Island where I was living when the project began. So the Doubleday family kept showing up time and time again on this journey, which is super weird considering it has nothing to do with baseball.
No, I know. It's just the mythology, you know, Doubleday Field, and you were there, mm-hmm. and then you found the ball, mm-hmm. and then you went found his grandson, and then lo and behold, you were at the grave in Chicago, and just by happenstance, that was where his dad was buried. It was just interesting to see how even though, you know, somebody credited him, you know, a group credited him back in what, the 30s or 20s or whenever they said he was the founder of baseball, and we've kind of learned that he really wasn't, but he keeps showing up in your book.
He does. He's a sneaky fellow.
Now, it seemed like you enjoyed going to the graves of these deceased players as opposed to meeting the living players. It seemed to be had some frustration when you started dealing with the living players. Is that something that I just read into it, or was that something that really happened?
It was meeting the living guys was a blessing and a curse. You know, I had opportunities to interact with some of the greatest names to ever play the game. And that's a profound thing that I would not have been able to experience otherwise. And I will cherish that forever. But there was a tedious aspect to meeting the living guys too. There was a lot of waiting around. I could not count how many hours I spent waiting for a living guy to become available. The way I got access to them was by befriending the promoters of the local baseball card shows. You know, I'm fortunate that I live in New York City, so the baseball card shows come through with some frequency. So I was able to connect with the people who ran those, and they gave me access to the players, which was a huge help. But it did often mean waiting for the players to finish doing the job that they were contractually there to do that day.
Sure.
So there was a lot of sitting around and waiting for them to become available to me for what was most of the time, you know, a 30-second exchange. So I had, certainly by the end, I was kind of done with that. Like, I think I had imagined that at some point, especially the book ended up being written about in the New York Times in 2016. And I think that I had a fantasy after that I wouldn't have to wait anymore. The project would have gained enough legitimacy at that point that I could have just walked in, taken my photos, and gone on. And that never actually happened. It was, you know, I waited just as long for the 72nd living Hall of Famer I photographed as I did for, you know, like the 10th one. There was a lot of waiting. Every now and then, some of them happened very quickly. This is a picture in there of Fergie Jenkins in the book, the Hallball photo for Fergie Jenkins. He was just sitting on the street, and I just walked by and asked, and he took the picture, and that whole thing took about 5 seconds. So sometimes, you know, it was quick and easy and fun and spontaneous like that. But a lot of the time, it was a lot of sitting and waiting.
And waiting, yeah.
Now, you really perfected your elevator pitch, I would assume.
I did. I got that sucker down to about 15 seconds. When I first started, the very first set of photos that I took of the Living Guys, which was induction weekend 2011, I didn't tell that batch of guys what I was doing. It was still photographing the new guy. The Living Guys was still a new experience for me. I was just trying to make it happen. I wasn't really thinking about any bigger picture. But after that first weekend, every time I interacted with one of the Living Guys and got them to pose for the photo, I told them, you know, the elevator pitch. They got the 15-second version of what this story is. What is the Hall Ball? What were my goals? What was I trying to do? And, you know, some of them thought it was fun. Some of them thought it was weird. Some of them told me to go away. It was... you know, I got mixed reactions, and, you know, that's to be expected. These are all, each one of these people is a different human being. So, you know, for some of them, it was pretty cool. And for others, you know, especially when they hear the cemetery portion of it, when they hear the part about going and visiting the dead Hall of Famers too. You know, there were a couple of them who weren't entirely sure I had all my wits about me.
That's funny. Now, you got to meet a lot, you know, obviously you got to meet a lot of these guys, and, you know, some of them were really cordial and had fun with you, like Reggie Jackson or Lou Brock.
Those were two of the best.
Was there a disappointment from you, you know, meeting your heroes? Because I know you were a card collector, a sports collector, a baseball fan. Was there a disappointment when you didn't get the reaction that you were expecting from some of these guys?
There wasn't, I have to be honest, actually. Part of that comes from my full-time career. I work in theater, and I work at that level of theater where I don't hang around with famous people often, but I, on occasion, do. And a lesson that I learned a while ago when dealing with fame is that it's not fair to sort of judge who these people are based on the one interaction we have.
Sure.
Anyone can have a bad day. Anyone can be in a bad mood. Anyone cannot understand why this crazy person doesn't want an autograph. I mean, you know, that's another one of those things that was off-putting for some of the guys, is that there are no autographs on the ball. We make that abundantly clear. It's just a picture. And a lot of these guys weren't used to that. They go to these baseball card shows, and they've got their pen in hand, and that's what they're there for. So to have someone come up and want something from them that didn't involve that was a new experience for some of them and put some of them on guard. So I tried to never really judge any of them too harshly from my, you know, very brief interaction with any of them. I've learned to temper my expectations for my heroes a while ago, and I believe that served me well along the way. I think it saved some heartache.
You asked, you know, you mentioned autographs, and we're TTM, which is through the mail autograph collecting podcast, and we write letters and ask for people for autographs, and it's a big thing that we do. But you made a concerted effort not to ask for autographs.
Yeah, there were a couple of reasons for that. There was a logistical reason, and then there was sort of a higher purpose reason. The logistical reason was just that. You know, I have one baseball, and there is at any moment 70 living guys. You can't get 70 legible signatures on a baseball. You can't really get more than, you know, 30, 35 before you start running out of room. So there was no way I was logistically going to be able to pull that off in the first place. It also sort of worked counter to that thought that I had at the beginning of using this project as a way to unify some of the bigger names from baseball history with some of the lesser known ones. You know, there's 300 and at this point, I guess 30 people in the Hall of Fame, and even the biggest baseball fans would struggle to name, you know, more than 100 of them. There's a lot of Hall of Famers that the fame tag is a little dubious. At least, you know, in a modern context. So part of that goal was to sort of bring all these guys on the same level, to bring them on the same playing field, as it were. And you know, autographs, having the living guys put a stamp on it when the deceased guys could not do that, that's just separating them even more. And then the final reason was really just, you know, autographs are a commodity. You know, they have a financial value to them. That was not a thing that I wanted to sort of play a role in what this project was. I didn't want to have a baseball that became more valuable every time someone put a signature on it. I just wanted a baseball that just sort of, I don't know, an emotional value that increased with each hand that it rested in, with each grave that it visited. I didn't want it to have a financial tie to it. I wanted it to be separate from that.
But we're speaking with Ralph Carhart. Ralph is author of a brand new book. It came out in June. It's called The Hall Ball. The Hall Ball, One Fan's Journey to Unite Cooperstown Immortals with a Single Baseball. And it certainly wasn't just a one-man show. You had all sorts of many supporters and people that you stayed with and helped you during your trip.
Yeah,
and you went all over the place and had people that helped support you. Ralph's new book is available on Amazon.com. It is available. Is it in bookstores yet, Ralph?
You know, yes, for where bookstores are open. If your bookstore doesn't have it, you can certainly go in and have them order it. If you don't want to order it through Amazon, you can go directly through the publisher, McFarlaneBooks.com, or I'm actually a member of a group called the Pandemic Baseball Book Club, which is a group of about myself and 20-some-odd other authors who had books that were coming out right now at this very unfortunate moment in history. So we've sort of all banded together to help promote each other's work. And if you go to our website, the PBBClub.com, there's a bookshop there where you can go and you can buy my book and all the other books, too, if you're interested.
Yeah, support authors. Keep people alive, you know. Keep writing alive, guys. This is a fantastic book. I recommend. When I got it, I couldn't put it down. It's a great read. It's a fun read. It's an educational read. Also, I'm a huge baseball fan, and I thought I knew all the Hall of Famers, but I didn't. There's a lot of people out there that I might only known their name or not even recognize their name. So Ralph does not miss any of the Hall of Famers. Ralph, are you surprised at the different graves, the gravestones that these Hall of Famers had, and how some of them mentioned their career, some of them didn't. Some didn't even really have graves. A couple of them, of the old Negro Leaguers, didn't even have a headstone. Were you sort of surprised how different that was?
It was instructional. I was surprised at the very beginning, but quickly enough, the patterns began to emerge that it became almost obvious eventually. The graves and the markers that we place in them, American society has sort of evolved over time in how we think of those and how elaborate they get and how big they get and what they should have on them or not have on them. And, interestingly enough, a large part of that is affected by economics, right? They're expensive things to buy a chunk of granite and have someone carve your name on it. Nowadays costs thousands of dollars. So ballplayers from a more modern ilk, their stones tended to be a little bit bigger, a little bit more elaborate. There were exceptions, too, that I think were sort of telling about who the men themselves were. Some of them chose very modest stones, even though they had the financial means to do more than that. But that wasn't who they were. Bob Feller is one that I'm thinking of, who I'm certain by the end of Bob Feller's life, if his family chose, they could have gotten one of the larger, more elaborate monuments. But his is very simple, very small. It's just his name and date. It doesn't mention baseball. It doesn't mention, interestingly enough, his time in the military. That was a recurring theme that I saw throughout the project as well, is that if there were a Hall of Famer who was a veteran, they were more likely to mention their military career on their stone than they were to mention their baseball career, which I thought was extraordinarily telling about those individuals as well. There were, the Negro Leaguers who, some of them have big, very fancy stones. Satchel Paige's is quite large and beautiful. Cool Papa Bell's is quite large and beautiful. But a number of them have government-issued stones because they were military. And when I began the project, there were three members of the Hall of Fame when I began the project who did not have any sort of stone whatsoever: Saul White, Frank Grant, and Pete Hill, who when I began, we didn't even know where Pete Hill was. A researcher, Jeremy Kropp, found Pete about, I don't know, within the first year of my journey, Jeremy found Pete. But those three guys were all Negro Leaguers. So, you know, the disparity between major league life and what life was in the Negro Leagues, even back, you know, in the 30s and 40s when major leaguers weren't certainly making the kind of money they make now, there was a stark line in the financial picture for those two different leagues. You definitely saw that represented.
You know what I found interesting in the book, in your summation of these guys' careers and lives, was what they did after, you know, they were retired. A lot of these guys, you know, especially back in the 30s and 40s and 50s, you know, when they were out of the limelight of Major League Baseball, you kind of lost touch of what they were doing. You did a great job of kind of humanizing them and say, oh, yeah, they went to sell insurance and work in a general store and work in a hardware store, or, you know, mm-hmm. be a janitor. Or, you know, mm-hmm. it was a different time, and I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, we have a habit, we fans, of sort of minimizing ball players, especially the greats, the ones in the Hall of Fame, down to their statistical output. And, you know, we tend to sometimes lose sight of who they are as humans because we're so in awe of the athletic feats that they accomplish when they're on the field. We forget that, you know, they're people when they go home. So I enjoyed those players whose stories after the game took them in a different direction. I enjoyed finding that and talking about that in the book.
Yeah, you organized the book by geography in a lot of instances, because you would pick a state, and you did New York and did some of the places in the Northeast, and you kind of picked a state, and then you went on these trips, and then you also did intermingled when you went to meet the live players. Was that did you know that's how you were going to organize the book, or was that something that kind of happened as you were getting close to finishing it?
That happened in the middle, certainly before I was close to finishing it. But at the beginning, the book looked very different in the beginning. And I had I have a thing, and the collectors who are listening to your show can probably appreciate that, what I'm about to say. But I have this thing where I like things to be in order. I like number one. I like number one to come before number two, to come before number three. You know, so I kept very careful track of the order in which I took the photos. And I, at first, wanted the book to be in order. I wanted the first thing I wrote about to be the first picture, the second thing I wrote about to be the second picture. But I soon discovered that if I tried to hold on to that perfection of the numbers, it was interfering with me being able to actually tell the story. Because, like, for example, as you said, ultimately, in the end, I basically broke the chapters down by the various states that I visited. So the very first chapter is New York. It's the state that I live in. It's the state where baseball began. And it made sense to sort of tell the story of all the guys who were buried in New York as one story. But the first few photos in that were like photos number one, photo number one was out of New York. And then I didn't get to the guys who were buried out in Buffalo until much later. So they're like number 140. So to go back, to have done that in order where I do each picture, I would have had to do this weird callback that as a storyteller wasn't working. So I decided to break it up by the various states, and that helped me tell the story a little more smoothly.
No, you got over 300 Hall of Famers, and we're going to talk about your six white whales in a minute. But over 20,000 miles, 34 states, 200 cities, Puerto Rico, Cuba. What surprised you the most about the journey?
What surprised me the most? Well, the thing that was the most fun was discovering just how much baseball is everywhere, right? I went on this journey with this very specific mission of chasing down the greatest in the history of the game. But baseball is so much more than the Hall of Fame and these 320 some odd guys. Baseball is the other 19,000 guys who played in the majors. Baseball is all the guys who played in the Negro Leagues. Baseball is the All-American Girl Professional Baseball League. Baseball is Little League. Baseball is, you know, a bunch of friends getting together and just kind of throwing the ball around. Even when I wasn't in a specific location where there was a grave, there was always some reminder of baseball there, whether it was, you know, going into a restaurant and there was a trophy sitting there, or, I was on the San Francisco Pier and there was a hot dog cart and it was shaped like a baseball stadium. Like it was, baseball just sort of permeates this country in a way that I didn't realize, you know, even someone who loves the game as much as I do, I miss, before going on this journey, just how much baseball plays a role in American life, even now that it isn't necessarily America's pastime. You know, football and basketball probably get bigger audiences than baseball do. But there's still something deeply embedded in the American fabric about baseball that doesn't apply to the other sports. And seeing that in action in all these little nooks and crannies of the country was enlightening.
That must have been really neat. It was a personal journey for you. You know, your wife found the ball and you brought your son and your daughter to when you were meeting the live Hall of Famers, the present Hall of Famers. And, one of the things that really interested me was how the connection between Mickey Mantle and JFK and your family.
Yeah, that visit, that trip, the trip to Texas, actually, I say that the book started to take shape around the midway point because the trip to Texas was the midway point. And that chapter, when I came home and started writing that one, it was different than anything I had written previously, and I really liked it. So I decided to model the rest of the book basically on that chapter. And the linchpin to that chapter, the thing that sort of made it special for me, was that unexpected connection. I grew up in a house with a father who worshipped Mickey Mantle. We grew up in upstate New York. So my dad was a kid in the 50s and 60s. And if you were a kid in the 50s and 60s in New York, Mickey Mantle was your idol. My mother's idol was John F. Kennedy. She had this box full of JFK magazines and books and all kinds of stuff that she used to keep on our front porch from when she was a little kid, from, you know, she was probably about 10, 11 years old when Kennedy was assassinated, that she kept her whole life. So my parents had these two very different idols, Mickey Mantle and JFK. And it wasn't until I was in Dallas to take the photograph of Mickey Mantle that I really began to think about just how close they are. The grave where Mickey Mantle, the mausoleum where Mickey Mantle is buried, is within 3 or 4 miles of Dealey Plaza. So, you know, Mickey is spending eternity not all that far from where JFK was assassinated. And the fact that these two people who not only mattered to my parents, but to all of America. I mean, you know, if you ask people in this country to make a top 5 list of famous, influential Americans, you're going to see JFK and Mickey Mantle on a lot of those lists, you know. So the fact that those two stories overlap like that it was meaningful to me, and it helped shape the direction I wanted to take with the book going forward.
And some of the living Hall of Famers passed away while you were writing this book, and you had the opportunity to meet Gary Carter, and for whatever circumstances that didn't happen, he passed away. Are there any regrets of not meeting any of the living Hall of Famers while they were alive, or is that something that
the Gary Carter is the single biggest project related regret, because I did have a chance to get him while he was alive, but I hadn't started photographing the living guys yet. And he was at a baseball card show that I was at, and I was gonna go and do it, and then I decided not to. I wanted to come up with a plan that I hadn't actually come up with yet. And I assumed at the time I'd have another chance to get Carter because, you know, he was, what, 55 at the time?
Right, young guy.
And that didn't happen. You know, within a few months, they announced his cancer. And you know, even though he survived the cancer for a while, he still was more removed from public life. He was no longer available to me after that moment. So I made a promise to myself that I wasn't going to waste another opportunity. If there was some Hall of Famer who was coming through town, it did not matter what else I had going on, I was going to find a way to get out there and meet them. So Carter's the only one that I regret. I sort of regret not having a chance to photograph Monty Irvin only because there were a number of circumstances in which I was in the neighborhood of Irvin. I just didn't know it at the time. You know, so I'm not as hard on myself about that one because I didn't know he was there. But there were two or three times in which I was not far away from where Monty Irvin was located, and if I had just known. So other than that, no, I knew at the beginning, you know, I was a realist. I knew it was going to take a while to accomplish this project. I knew there were guys who were going to be alive when I started who were not going to be alive when I finished, and I would just, you know, have to roll with it when it happened.
One of the strangest stories, obviously, is one of my heroes growing up, Mr. Ted Williams. Was that kind of weird for you? Because he doesn't really have a gravestone, or, you know, you had to go to the office building to find him.
Yes. So for Ted Williams, I went to the Alcor Life Extension Facility in Scottsdale, Arizona, and I took the tour. Anyone can have a tour of the facility that would like. They are a business, and they're trying to sell you a product, and they're happy to take you on a tour and show you around. And the final stop in the tour is a view of the room where they keep the doers, the containers that they put the people who've been vitrified. You can see the containers. They would not tell me which container Mr. Williams was in. They have strict privacy policies regarding their clients. But you know, he's one of them, you know, you can see pretty much the whole room. So he was one of them. It was different. You know, I'm a guy who hangs out in cemeteries. So I already have a hobby that most people find weird, if not a little creepy. And that doesn't bother me. I love cemeteries, but going into the Alcor Life Extension Facility, I have to admit, was mildly unnerving. Because for the rest of us, having the conversation about being cryogenically frozen is one that you know, dances between fiction or between fact and science fiction, right? Like, sure, science says certain things are possible, but we don't really think this is actually possible. And when you're in that building, everyone who works there believes completely in what they're doing. They are 100% certain that Ted Williams is not dead. Ted Williams is just waiting for science to figure out whatever they need to, you know, cure old age. And he will be back with us in time. And that was most definitely an interesting experience.
To say the least. I mean, he lived an interesting life, and he's living an interesting post-life, if you will.
So, yeah, for sure.
I hope we're all wrong, and he can come back and hit 400 one day.
I mean, you know, wouldn't that be the ultimate kicker to end this story if we learn in the end that they were right all along?
Yeah. You don't know. Well, Alexander Cartwright holds a kind of special place for you in the book in your personal life as a baseball historian. A lot of people might not recognize the name. Why don't you tell us a little about Alexander Cartwright and, you know, while he was living and why you've gravitated towards him and kind of closed the book out with him.
Alexander Cartwright is the counter argument to Abner Doubleday. When the powers that be in baseball, and it was essentially a debate between Al Spalding and Henry Chadwick, who the inventor of baseball was, And when Spalding's committee, which was actually way back, it was even before the 20s and 30s, it was at the turn of the century, when Spalding's committee capped Doubleday as the founder, there were, quote unquote, more serious historians who knew that Doubleday was not the answer. It had to be someone else. And they went with a guy named Alexander Cartwright. Cartwright was in fact a member of the New York Knickerbockers. He was one of the first guys to play on the team. He probably umpired the first game. He had a role, but essentially everything that's on Alexander Cartwright's plaque, which are some of the basics. So his plaque in the Hall of Fame claims that he invented nine innings and nine men to a side and 90-foot base paths. And what we now know is that none of that is true. Alexander Cartwright had relatively little to do with the formation of the rules that ended up becoming what we think of as baseball. So even the person who was capped by the serious historians as the inventor of baseball didn't really invent baseball. However, I love the Alexander Cartwright story because I'm a huge fan of 19th century baseball, of the founding of baseball, of the story of its creation. And the role that Alexander Cartwright has played, even though, you know, he's not the one that the credit really belongs to, is that he has served as the reminder that time happened. One of the great flaws in the Hall of Fame, in my opinion, is that they have a whole category for something called pioneers. It's, you know, it's the executives / pioneers. And baseball does not do the Veterans Committee, the Hall of Fame, does not really do a great job of exploring those pioneers who were the men who brought it all about. So much of the Hall of Fame, whether it's you're elected in by the Baseball Writers of America or by the Veterans Committee, it's also statistically based. And, you know, if you were playing baseball in 1850, the statistics are absolutely meaningless.
Sure.
But what was your role? Now, we have the person that all those rules, all those things that we credit to Cartwright belong to is actually a guy named Doc Adams. Doc was on the ballot, I think, in 2016. He came close. I think he was two votes shy. After that ballot, it was discovered, a document was discovered known as the Laws of Baseball, which is essentially those rules that we think of now, 90 feet, nine men, nine innings, written in 1857 in Doc Adams's very own hand. So I'm hoping he's up again this year for the Hall of Fame, and I'm hoping Doc gets elected because it gives that legitimate nod to those pioneer folks that I think the Hall of Fame neglects. But Cartwright, beyond being that connection to the 19th century that's so enticing to me, part of why I was so very much looking forward to visiting his grave was because he's buried in Hawaii. when Alexander Cartwright left New York, we know Alexander Cartwright was not involved in the development of the rules that we play by now, because those didn't happen until the 1850s. And in 1849, Alexander Cartwright left New York and he went to California. He went to San Francisco to be a minor 49er. And he tried that out for a few months. That didn't work out. He had an opportunity to get some work in Japan. He had a brother in Japan. So he got on a boat to go to Japan and was so horribly, horribly seasick that when the boat stopped in Hawaii to resupply, he got off and he never got on another one. And he spent the rest of his life in Hawaii, and he became a very influential person in Hawaii. He was a volunteer firefighter like so many of the 19th century pioneer baseball guys. He brought firefighting prevention techniques to Hawaii and upgraded their system. He became a confidant of the king and queen. Keep in mind, Hawaii wasn't a state yet. He became a confidant to the king and queen of Hawaii, a rarity for a white man such as him. He's revered in that area. When I went to take the picture, it was, I'm going to say it's on purpose, but it was really coincidentally, his birthday. So there was a special event happening at his grave that I got to attend because there is still a large group of people, baseball fans in Hawaii, who revere his contributions, even if they weren't really his contributions.
Got you. That's interesting. He led a really interesting life.
He did. It was one of the most fascinating ones, one of the most.
Well, you had an interesting interaction with Chipper Jones from the Atlanta Braves. He was the last living Hall of Famer that had his picture taken with the ball. And why don't you tell us a little about that?
So I made a point when I was doing the elevator pitch and giving the ball to the player, to make it clear to them as quickly as possible that I didn't want them to sign it. I may have hesitated for a moment with Chipper Jones because he was the last one, and there was the enormity of the moment was all happening to me, and maybe I didn't speak as quickly as I normally did because before I realized it, he was starting to sign it. So I say there are no signatures on the ball. That's a lie. There is one letter. He got as far as writing the letter C before I screamed, no!
Your heart must have stopped.
And he looked at me like I had lost my mind. and then I explained to him what was going on and why I didn't want him to, and he gave me sort of like a half-hearted grin after that for the photo. Chipper was the very last living guy, and there is, in fact, when you look at the ball, one letter of one autograph written on it, and it's Chipper C.
Well, it wouldn't be the story, and it wouldn't be the ball if there wasn't something like that. I want to go back to the beginning, and before we end the interview, and just the guys, we've outlined a lot of Ralph's book, and it's a great book. It's called The Hall Ball, and we're going to talk about how he came up with the name Hall Ball and what happened with the Hall Ball at the very beginning. At the end, there is a twist.
Let's call it a twist. The ending of the book has a twist. Yeah.
Has a twist. So we're not going to ruin it for you. And also, there are six white whales, and we're not going to disparage any of the people that he did not have the opportunity to take a picture with while they were alive. One of them has passed away, and there's a few others that had not. He didn't get to take pictures with, so he didn't get every single one. But we're not going to bring those up. That is featured in his book, and there's reasons why these gentlemen did not get the picture taken with. I really want to go back to the ball because I really love the story of you were at the Hall of Fame with your family. You put the ball in the car, not realizing it was going to be the center of this book, and you started you started doing a couple of grave sites, and you couldn't find the ball.
Yeah, I knew I wanted to use this ball, but it had disappeared in the car. We had been doing a lot of traveling that summer. We were doing a lot of camping, so the car was a mess. It was filled with tents and blankets and pillows and stuff. And I was in the middle of the first cemetery, and I was trying to find that ball. I knew that was the ball I wanted, and I tore that car apart, and I couldn't find it. So I used a different ball because I've always got a spare baseball. I used a different ball, but it wasn't the ball I wanted. So I ended up, once I did find that baseball, starting over again. There was a false start where I took about five or six pictures and then found the real ball and had to start all over again.
And the ball had some interesting reactions. You outlined them in the book from living Hall of Famers, people that would look at this ball and say, what are you using this ball for? Yeah, I think Jim Rice was one of them.
Right, Jim Rice was one of the funniest. Because it's not a Major League Baseball. It's not an official licensed Major League Baseball. It's made by Diamond. It was from their line that they sell to high schools. It had probably been used in one of the traveling kids games that you play on Doubleday Field. It had green writing all over it, and it had been sitting in a creek. It was a smudged, waterlogged, and not what you would expect for a major league product, right?
Yeah.
But I'm an underdog. I root for the underdogs, and I wanted a baseball that had a little grit, had a little dirt, and quite honestly, it was pulled from a creek in Cooperstown. What other baseball could have a better pedigree than that?
Yep. Now, Reggie Jackson had some fun with you.
Yes, I described what the project was, and I just wanted them to hold it. And Reggie said to me, so you just want me to hold it? I'm like, yeah. He's like, you want me to hold it like this? And then he held the ball out with his middle finger stuck up, and he gave me the finger. And I said, yes, that is exactly what I want. I want a picture that is the essence of Reggie Jackson. And we took the shot, and everyone in the room just busted up laughing. But then his representative, his agent, his manager, whoever was there assisting him that day, was like, yeah, we should delete that. So we did. They deleted it, and I took a different picture of Reggie. But the smile that's on Reggie's face in that picture is very genuine, because we had all just finished laughing at his very Reggie photo.
Did any of the players intimidate you at all? Just not physically, just you had apprehensions about beating them because of their reputation? Or
Bob Gibson. And maybe that Bob Gibson was one of the ones that I had to ask more than once. There were a couple of them that I refused me the first time. Bob Gibson also refused me a second time. It took me 3 tries to get the picture of Bob Gibson. And maybe it was maybe the reason was because I approached him as an intimidated person. You know, he was such a warrior out there on the field that maybe he smelled my weakness and that turned. But he's a very intimidating presence in a way that almost none of the other Hall of Famers were, quite frankly. Most of them, especially in the situations where I was meeting them, right, where they were there to meet the fans. They were seeing stuff. Very few of them, for whatever reason it was, and I can't even tell you, Bob Gibson just intimidated me.
That's funny. I mean, I always marvel because I go to card shows. And I'm not a big in-person autograph guy, but mm-hmm. I will get them. And I always marvel at players. You know, it doesn't have to be a Hall of Famer story, that they're at a show and the people are paying for their autograph, but their disposition is like they'd rather be 20 other places than where they are then.
I got to be honest. I bought a house once. And the forms that I had to fill out to finalize that deal, at the closing of the house, I probably signed my name 50 times. And by the time I was done, I didn't even know what my own signature looked like anymore. So, you know, to have your job that day to write your name, you know, however many times they can squeeze in one of those hour and a half long sessions, 200 times, there's got to be... I imagine you have to get a little zen about it, especially because, you know, sometimes the fans can be a little intense. We've all met those guys. We all know the ones whose boundaries are a little off. So, you know, I can, again, like I said before, there were certainly moments in which I was disappointed, but I never really tried to hold it against anybody for any extended period of time because it's not easy. I know it seems like it should be, right? You show up, you sign your name for an hour and a half, you walk away with a bunch of money. But it's not. It's really not. I can imagine that being a particularly challenging gig.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. But they know what they're signing up for, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yes. It's true. It's true. So. And there are, you know, and it does make the ones who manage to do it with a smile and be more personable it makes them stand out even more, right? You sort of notice who those guys are. And there's an energy that comes off of them. You know, Jim Thome just put off just this most positive energy. Like he was just, it was great, you know, to have that brief interaction with him and to see people who really do get a thrill out of it still. Now, you know, I got Jim Thome on, you know, the day he was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. So he had a lot of good energy going that day.
Right. He was on a natural high anyway.
Right. And, you know, and Bob Gibson's been doing this for, you know, 50 years at this point. So I get it. I get it. Yeah, you know, in the end, I was able to accomplish what I wanted to accomplish.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fabulous journey. It's a fabulous task. I'm envious that I didn't think of it. I'm sorry that I didn't.
It's not too late. You can make your own. I just today, actually, in fact, updated my website. I've been very lax in updating the website. I'm a terrible salesman. This is the part where being an author is going to be a particular challenge for me in this modern era. I'm a terrible salesman. I can't sell anything, but I'm trying to sell my book now. And one of the things I've done towards that is I'm working on updating my website, which has not been updated in like a year and a half or so. And I just added a brand new feature today where you can go to the website, and I have published a map where you can go to all of the graves and the symbolic locations. There were a number of guys in the project who, when they passed, they were not buried, they were cremated. So for them, I chose some symbolic locations to take the photographs. If you go to thehallball.com and then click on the map, you will be able to explore around the United States and Cuba, all the different places that I went in the little corners of this country, cities big and small, and, find out how close the nearest Hall of Famer is buried to where you live.
Well, now you know what I'm going to be doing for the next hour today. I'm sure my wife won't be too happy about that.
Yeah, sorry about that.
we're speaking with Ralph Carhart. Ralph is a Brooklyn-based theater director and manager. He is a baseball historian. He is active in the Sabre, and he has written a new book. It is called The Hall Ball, One Fan's Journey to Unite Cooperstown Immortals with a Single Baseball. Just remember The Hall Ball. It is a great name for this. The book is a great name for the ball itself. It's a great name for the journey. Ralph, why don't you give everyone, your web address again, if they want to find you on Twitter or any social media, any way to reach out to you. You guys, go buy this book. It's a fun read.
The website is thehallball.com. Nice and easy to find. And my Twitter handle is just my name, @RalphCarhart. I have a Facebook as well, but I'm never there anymore. I'm sort of retiring the Facebook, especially now that after I do a big publicity push for the book, I'll probably be retiring Facebook. So the best way to get me on social media is Twitter, @RalphCarhart.
Great. Do you have a second act speaking in your vernacular?
I am working on another book. I am this time, while I'm still paying off the credit cards from all the travel on the Hall Ball, I have decided that the new book is going to be about Brooklyn, where I live, so I don't really need to go all that far.
I'm sure your wife is happy and your kids, because I know, like my kids, your kids are not big baseball fans, right?
The little one is. The older child is not into baseball at all, but the little one loves it. In fact, she's super disappointed. She was just opining the other day because there is no baseball this year. She's very disappointed.
me and her both.
Yeah. It's pretty brutal.
All right, Ralph, before I let you go, is there anything that we didn't talk about or discuss about the book or about what you have going on? Or?
Oh, I don't know. I could talk about this book for another, 4 hours, but why don't we let these poor people go?
I could, too. So, I have a segment on my show that I call Catching Up, so I always try to follow up with some of my guests and see how they're doing. So I'm sure I'll be calling you in a few months to see how the book goes and get caught up with what's going on with your life and how your new book is going. So I really appreciate your time today. I wish you the best of luck with the book. If there's anything you'd like me to do to help promote it, I'm always here for you.
The only thing I'm telling folks is that if you enjoy the book, please tell someone else. Oh, and Amazon reviews. I've been told that reviews at Amazon really do help sell a book. So if folks read the book and they like it, please pop over to Amazon, leave a review there, and help move this up in their algorithm higher up the list so people see it.
All right. Well, good luck. And again, it was a pleasure meeting you.